Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable and to our debrief segment this morning. For more on Syria and the crisis in the country, we're joined by President of Mideast, Ambassador Theodore Khatouf. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Syria and the United Arab Emirates. He's also served as a Middle East analyst at the U.S. State Department. He'll be coming to the Hudson Valley to give a lecture for the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. The talk will be April 8th at 7 o'clock in the Hancock Center at Marist College. The title of the talk is Charting a Path for U.S. Policy Toward Syria, ISIS, and across the Middle East. While in the region, he'll also be speaking to students at Bard College about diplomacy and will attend an event at Vassar College as well. We are very pleased to welcome Ambassador Theodore Khatouf to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Alan, it's fascinating of looking, obviously we've been talking a lot about this issue, a lot about Syria, a lot about ISIS, so I'll let you start here.
Well, Ambassador, I guess the big question a lot of people have is, have we been playing our cards right? Now, I know that, you know, you've had a lot to do with it, but there are those people who think, yeah, you know, we put our money on some of the outliers and say that they're going to be the voice of democracy, and it turns out they're anything but that. So should we have just kept our mouths shut and let the people who are running things continue to run it? Were we better off that way?
Well, I think if we go back to the end of 2010 when Tunisians were in the streets and sure. The beginning of 2011 when Egyptians did the same, it's hard for the United States, as a country that upholds the values of democracy, pluralism, free speech, sovereignty lies in the choice of the people, to ignore what was going on and to say, oh, let's continue business as usual and throw our full weight behind Mubarak in Egypt and Ben Ali in Tunisia. I don't think that was really a choice any administration could make in light of events there. But obviously, revolutions often don't turn out the way their perpetrators hope. And in the case of young Egyptians, I think it's fair to say they didn't expect what ensued, that is, the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood to power, and then the military, whether we call it a coup or whatever we want to call it, reasserting power, and General Sisi in some ways not ruling that much differently from Mubarak. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we weren't presented with easy choices, and none of what's going on today presents us with easy choices. In most cases, it's the least bad choice that we can try to take.
Okay, so if you were the emperor of the world, what's the solution? What should we do now?
Well, emperor of the world is, I'm not sure I've ever quite contemplated that.
Okay, if you were in charge, what would we do?
If I was in charge, well, first of all, you know, the Sunni-Shia split, particularly in the eastern part of the Arab world, and it's very pronounced in places like Iraq, Bahrain, Syria, Lebanon, and now Yemen, is poisonous because it's, you know, these struggles are now taking on a very religious character, and you can't really negotiate with people who believe that God is instructing them as to what to do. And so the first thing would be to try to make the players see that a religiously tinged struggle is in no one's interest, and only bad things can come from it, as we've been seeing with massacres and other outrages that have occurred. And of course, nobody is more outrageous or more barbaric than the so-called Islamic State or ISIS. So, you know, one would want to get the parties, as diplomats always hope to do, talking. But, you know, right now the Saudis tend to be championing Sunni groups in the region, not all of them by any means. It wouldn't be fair to claim that they're supporting the Islamic State. They're not. Or Al-Qaeda. They're not. But generally, they're looking to suppress movements that are Shia in character and enjoy Iran's backing, who, in Iran, of course, it was a religious revolution, and they see themselves as the champions of, they claim to be the champions of all good Muslims, but in reality, they back Shia movements in Iraq and in Lebanon and now in Yemen.
So should
the Alawites, of course, in Syria.
So should we just stay out? I mean, after all, Ambassador, you know, and I know, you know better than anyone, that I think Egypt is our number two recipient of foreign aid in this world, and we're just now, with al-Sisi giving him back the money that we supposedly were sitting on for a little while, Mubarak has basically been replaced by another Mubarak. Now, the question for the United States is, what? Just what do we do? You say, okay, we should negotiate between the, you know, the two groups, but I don't know how we do that. And do you have any specifics on how you would start it?
No, and I'm sort of with you on the idea that I'm not sure we, you know, it's a little bit like a policeman arriving in the middle of a family feud,
sure.
You know, a violent family feud, and we know often it's the policeman who is the one that is stabbed or shot before matters are over. So it's not the U.S.'s place to try to sort out every dispute in the region, and certainly not disputes that involve interpretations of Islam and the role that Islam should play in the governance of people in predominantly Islamic countries. As I said, we don't have a lot of good choices. I sometimes say, how would it have worked out if during the 30 Years' War in the 17th century, when Protestants and Catholics were brutally slaughtering one another in Central Europe, if the Ottoman Sultan in Istanbul had said, you know what? We Muslims, we ought to go and sort this out for the Christians.
Yeah.
I don't think that might have worked. Any more than I think it's going to work for the U.S. to try to dictate outcomes in the region. I think what we should be doing is looking after our interests, which means supporting groups that are for pluralism, are for tolerance and the like. But I agree, they're few and far between. The other thing we can do is recognize that the greatest threats to stability in the region right now are the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and their many offshoots, whether we're talking about Boko Haram in Nigeria or Libyan radical jihadists, whomever allies themselves with those groups. And we should be supporting those governments and those groups, and when I say groups, I'm talking about, for instance, the Kurds in Iraq, who are willing to work with us to degrade the capabilities of these groups and try to contain them and ensure that they're limited in the kinds of terrorist attacks they can undertake. What I'm talking about, of course, is what we're seeing in Kenya today. This Somalian jihadist group that has attacked particularly one college campus and is vowing to kill Christians there.
Al-Shabaab. So let us just talk for a moment about, as you were saying, that we have really no good choices presented to us at the moment. And I'm interested in an historic perspective and your perspective on, did we miss the boat on anything? Was there a ship that sailed that got us into this position? Or are we looking at a very much a cyclical situation where there really never have been good options for us?
Well, I think original sin, you know, if we want to get really historical, original sin was after World War One. Wilson had great ideas about self-determination and, you know, democratic ideals and the like. And the imperialists of the day, the British and the French, the victors, carved up the Middle East and North Africa. And the U.S., of course, withdrew largely from responsibility for what was going on in much of the rest of the world after World War One until the beginning of World War II. And so we had a lot of artificial borders drawn up for the convenience of the British and the French that had very little to do with the composition of the states in terms of their religions, their ethnicities, and the like. This was true in Lebanon. It was true in Syria, Iraq. Of course, the Balfour Declaration created Israel, but the British at the same time promised the Arabs that nothing would be done to prejudice their rights with the creation of a homeland for the Jewish people. And so a mess was preordained. In fact, there was a well-known book that was written a couple decades ago about this very subject, The Peace to End All Peace, talking, of course, about the Treaty of Versailles and particularly focusing on the Middle East aspects of what went on after that treaty. But bringing things more up to date, I think the invasion of Iraq, we can now say, was a mistake. I think it's hard to get around that. Iran's influence is greater than ever. Saddam was an awful person, an awful dictator, a bloody guy. But if we're going to look at realpolitik, Saddam was a bulwark against Iran, and in a sense, a shield for much of the rest of the world, or much of the rest of the region, excuse me, against Iran's hegemonic ambitions. And we removed that barrier. And the policies we followed in Iraq, the dissolution of the army, et cetera, sort of dealing with groups on the basis of their ethnicities, of the Kurds, dealing with Shiites and Sunnis on the basis of their religious affiliations, just tended to sharpen the divisions within those societies. And now the cancer has spread.
Did you see Assad on 60 Minutes?
I saw some of it, yes.
What did you make of it? He's extremely articulate, I thought. But did you think that he was covering up some of his real sins?
Of course he's covering up some of his real sins. He knows that his father ruled a fractious society with an iron hand. He comes from a minority sect, the Alawites, that are an offshoot of Shia Islam. They comprise only about 12% of the population. And yet he was determined to remain the leader of the country and keep his factions on top. And yet two-thirds of his country are Sunni Arabs. And I'm not saying every Sunni Arab hated Bashar al-Assad and the regime. Many of them benefited, but most did. And not least because they didn't feel like they were sharing in any of the wealth of the society. They felt that they were the majority group, but they were marginalized and disrespected. And thus we see what we see today, because Assad chose to fight rather than try to negotiate with the opposition and perhaps, as the U.S. wanted, for him to eventually step aside and work out a power-sharing arrangement with the more peaceful opposition. Now there is no, there are no centrists that count for anything on the battlefield in Syria. We have two extremely radical Islamist groups, the ISIS, the Islamic State, being one, and the Nusra Front, which is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, being the other. And those are the dominant groups. And Turkey to the north, Erdogan, the president, is so fed up with Assad, he doesn't seem to care very much who comes out on top initially if it gets rid of Assad. And that's worrying as well, because as bloody as Assad is, I'm afraid that anybody, either of the two groups I just mentioned, were to become the dominant powers throughout Syria, we would see massacres on a scale far surpassing anything we've seen to date.
So have we made a mistake, is my question, in, you know, basically committing ourselves, the president has over and over again, to getting rid of Assad when what you've just posited as the alternative looks so terrible?
I would say that, yes, I think the president has made a lot of good decisions, but I think his decision early on in this uprising to say Assad must go was a mistake. And why was it a mistake? A, it was a mistake because we didn't have the means to make him go. And as a superpower, you shouldn't declare that you want certain things unless you're willing to pay a price to get it, which we weren't. And secondly, we clearly overrated the power of the moderate opposition and totally underrated the fighting prowess of the radical Islamists in the region. And thus, even if, you know, and thus now they've made it quite clear, I think, that they're not really looking for Assad to step aside. It's a little bit like the story that St. Augustine prayed for chastity, but being a rather dissolute fellow before he was St. Augustine, he said, "But God, just not yet." And the administration won't admit that they've given up their goal to get rid of Assad, but they're certainly signaling that they don't see any reason for him to go right now.
So your talk, which you'll be giving on April 8th at Marist College, and as I mentioned, you'll also be speaking at Vassar and Bard, charting a path for U.S. policy toward Syria, ISIS, and across the Middle East. With that path that you are going to talk about charting, where does your optimism lie?
There is no optimism. I'm sorry to say. I mean, I don't want to sound cynical or defeatist, but you know, we cannot.
So, what are we charting a path toward?
We have to look after our interests first and foremost. And our first and principal interest right now is degrading. I don't know that we can eliminate them, but greatly degrading the ability of radical jihadist groups that want to create caliphates and attack the rest of the world, working with those who are willing to work with us on that particular task. It's not our job, I think, to decide who's going to come out on top in Yemen or to try to thread the needle in the Syrian civil war, which can't be done, in my opinion, anyway. It's our job to stand with those who stand with us against these terrorist groups, first and foremost.
Ambassador Theodore Khatouf will be coming to the Hudson Valley to give a lecture for the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. The talk will be April 8th at 7 o'clock at the Hancock Center at Marist College. Again, the title of the talk, Charting a Path for U.S. Policy Towards Syria, ISIS, and Across the Middle East. Ambassador Khatouf, I thank you very much for being with us this morning and sharing your knowledge and expertise.
Thank you.
A great pleasure. Thank you. For more information, you can go to WAMC.org. We have links posted there to a Mideast website, as well as the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley website for more information. And again, we thank you for being with us. Alan, thank you.
And thank you, Joe.